What do you say after that? My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is by the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon family groups. I am powerless over people, places, and things. And because of the program, I can make this admission today without feeling guilty. My life continues to be unmanageable when I fail to practice principles that were given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Which one of these things am I supposed to talk into? This one? Okay. Bill hates people that miss the microphone. I like to believe that the early members of the AA, the early families, I'll say this right, I like to believe that the families of the early members of AA were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program would work for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups grew to reach all over the world and have shown astounding results. We subscribe to the concept that alcoholism is a family illness. And then we get so carried away telling people how sick we got that we forget to say, we have a program for family recovery. And that's what this weekend is all about. You'll listen to the speakers and you'll go to the workshops and some instances we have Alateens present. And we see whole families working together in recovery. And this is an absolutely joyous and wonderful thing to be involved in a celebration like this. And the AA people just delight me. When they get together, they are so pleased to see each other. And I think it's more evident in the big international things. They charge across the room and beat each other on the back. And everybody is, as Chuck Chamberlain used to say, everybody's talking, nobody's listening. And then someone comes in that back door back there, and they stop right in the middle of a sentence, and they say, oh, look. There comes old George, and he's still sober. They don't even expect each other to stay sober. Love without expectancy, I think it's called. And again, I want to say how pleased I am to be here this weekend. And I bring you greetings from my Bill. He doesn't travel with me anymore, but he insists that I keep my commitments. He gets weaker every day, it seems to me. He weighs 120 pounds now, and he's almost 6 foot tall. And he's gradually losing his eyesight, so he's more and more restricted all the time. And I haven't quite worked through the guilt feeling that I have when I leave him behind. But he tells me that I'm easier to live with if I take a break. So I'm taking a break so I'll be easier to live with. I talked to our daughter last night, and they're getting along fine. Peggy comes up from San Angelo weekends when I'm away, and she gives him a manicure and a massage and pets him to death, and then I have to live up to that when I get home. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups, and this doesn't mean very much until you get to be a long-timer. And it isn't hard to do. All you have to do is keep coming to meetings and stay alive. One of our AA friends out in Midland, Texas says, don't drink and don't die. But it's been my great privilege to be around for a long, long time. It's been my privilege and great joy to talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. And I've learned about people. People are all alike. Every one of you who are here today are here for exactly the same reason that I'm here. We were driven here under the cruel lash of alcoholism because we had nowhere else to go. Nowhere else to go. And I once thought that alcoholism was a product of my generation, but this isn't true. Alcoholism is an insidious, progressive, fatal illness that prompts the unthinking to make jokes about drunks, but it can leave a family homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I have been able to learn, seemed to do very much about alcoholism until the advent of AA. Priests and ministers were baffled at their inability to cope with this insidious habit, this dreadful malady, if you please. They preached to alcoholics, prayed over you, had you to sign pledges. And when these things failed, they damned your soul to hell. Men of science in other generations wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the medical students, "Don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless." Preachment failed, and there was no cure. So there was only one other thing to do with alcoholics. You must be punished. So we locked you up in jail. The more you drank, the longer we kept you in jail. And the longer we kept you in jail, the drunker you got when you were released. It became a vicious cycle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. And society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. We'll never know, I'm sure, how many sick alcoholics have died in the jails around our country at the hands of sadistic jailers. We'll have no way of knowing. But there was one group of people who never gave up on the alcoholic. That was the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We picked up your hot checks, bailed you out of jails. We pled with judges. We said, "John's a good man when he's sober." And to complete this ridiculous paradox, we gave you hell every time you got drunk. And society was puzzled at the behavior of the families of alcoholics. They could not understand us. They seemed to feel that we were endowed with some special quality that made us better than other people, that we were willing to continue to love and care for the alcoholic. Some of them thought we were plain damn fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. She used to say, "God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of our abuse and bill." And Mother was right. Mother was right. God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. And then a little later on, of course, the professionals got involved. They were the ones that put the labels on us, such things as aggravating influences, disturbing factors. I just like that one. And all during this time, we were just trying to do what we could to follow the direction of the AA people that loved us to try to get well again. And all of these research projects that they were going. I remember one time the government spent an awful lot of money, and a lady who shall remain nameless was in charge of that project, and their object was to find out what kind of women marry alcoholics. And they spent all that money and didn't find out a thing that they didn't know to start with. Women don't marry alcoholics. Women marry men that they love, and some of them are alcoholics. But this is the kind of thing that went on. They spent thousands and thousands of dollars for the rehabilitation of the alcoholics. We have treatment centers on every corner of every town in the whole United States, I think. And not one nickel was directed to the rehabilitation of the families of alcoholics, who, by Will Wilson's own admission, were a lot sicker than the drunks. And so I got all caught up in this, and I decided I'd do some research. You know, it's fair about, the time about's fair play, don't you think? So I started a research project, and I learned during this research that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He had conquered the whole known civilized world when he was only 33 years old, and he wept because there were no world rules to conquer. But he couldn't conquer his desire to drink, and he died in an alcoholic convulsion. I learned that Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. He gave the world his most beautiful folk music, but he could not overcome his compulsive drinking. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his Jeannie with the light brown hair, but the love of his wife couldn't keep him sober. And he died on the New York Bowery, buried in an unmarked grave because he was an alcoholic. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories, and he all but destroyed himself with the magic that he found in a bottle. It could have been a fifth of gin or a quart of bourbon. And he describes the personality change of the alcoholic in the story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched this personality change right in my own living room, just like a lot of you did. You saw the bottle change the man you love, change him into a babbling idiot, into a degenerate animal, into a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, history said very little about the families of these men and others like them, but I believe with all my heart that I know the loneliness and the fear that Jeannie knew when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from a spree. And I believe that I know the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she left her home in California to go to a South Sea island with her husband in hopes that he might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He also had tuberculosis. And I believe that I know the joy that they knew when he did regain his health. And I believe I know to some degree the serenity that they both knew when he found sobriety. Am I? Friends in Al-Anon give me a hard time about my history lesson. They say, why on earth do you feel it necessary every time you get a hold of a microphone to give us a history lesson? And of course, I have a good reason. I can't tell jokes. I always forget the punchline. No, that isn't it at all. I tell you these things to point out something that I feel is very significant. Disease of alcoholism is a universal thing, and with all the effort that is being made, and there is tremendous effort being made in the professional field, and I appreciate this, and I never want to put down our friends in the professions. Bill Wilson said we should be friendly with our friends in the profession, and with all the effort that they're making, and it's a tremendous amount. It's almost impossible anymore to pick up a magazine or a newspaper and not find an article on alcoholism. I was absolutely amazed last year to find an article on alcoholism in the Atlantic Monthly. You know, that's a prestigious manuscript, and they're very selective with the things they publish. But there it was, Big as Life and Twice as Natural. And it seems to me that currently, it's the end thing to have an alcoholic in your home. Now, if you don't have one, I strongly suggest that you go out and get one. Wait just a minute. Don't marry them. Just borrow them. They're the handiest things you can have. They're as handy as a pocket on the shirt. Everything that goes wrong, you can blame the alcoholic. So every family should have one. But with all the effort that's being made, it's now possible, as you all know, to get an alcoholic in the treatment center when their problem becomes critical. County sheriffs no longer put alcoholics in jail simply for drunkenness. They send them to treatment centers. Ministers send alcoholics to AA meetings so they can get well, and they send their families to us so they can get well, too. But with all the effort in all the areas that is being made at this point in time, these people are just not getting the job done. Have you noticed that? They are not getting the job done. And the reason they're not getting the job done is because they don't know all there is to know about alcoholism. So in my opinion, this moment, I am looking at a room full of experts. You're the people who know about alcoholism because you have lived with it. So in my opinion, this is a job for you to do. A job for you and for me. And I learned this a long, long time ago. When I came here, there were 50 groups in the world. 50 Al-Anon family groups in the whole world, that's all. I haven't heard a recent delegates report, but the last report that I had, we now have over 40,000 Al-Anon family groups. And we went to the International out in Salt Lake City. There were representatives there from 122 countries. There was two countries that were not represented, and so the staff members stood in for those two. It was absolutely fantastic. It's unbelievable. And it's been my privilege and great joy to watch this fellowship evolve through the years. It's been the most fascinating thing that I've ever done in my life. I wouldn't take $1 million for it. But I'll tell you the second chapter, I wouldn't do it again for another million. When I came here, as I said, there was only 50 groups in the world, and we did not have a program. We did not have a program to live by, but worse than that, we did not have a purpose to live for. All we really had in those early days was the awareness of a great need for help and the dubious permission of some people who were very new in AA to come to their meeting places while they had a meeting, and that's what we did. Anywhere we could put a few chairs, dirty little kitchens and wide hallways around the country, we sat together and we talked. Now you know very well what we talked about. It was kind of a morbid competition to determine which one of us lived with the sorriest man. And I wasn't comfortable in those meetings because I did not live with a sorry man. I lived with a fine young man who drank too much. But the dear people who put the life-changing program together for Alcoholics Anonymous were aware of the fact that in time the families of alcoholics would become aware of this need for help. Al-Anon is a kissing cousin to invention, you know. They were both born of necessity. And very gradually, over a long period of time, we did indeed become aware of this necessity to get some help. And when they wrote the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they made provisions for us because they included in that book two chapters for the families of alcoholics. And you very well know what they are. One of these chapters is entitled Two Wives. Now, that is not intended to be a put-down for the fine men who are members of the Al-Anon family groups. The fact of the matter is that when that book was written, there were no women in AA, so they addressed that chapter to wives. The early groups in Canada called their groups the wives' groups. And the other chapter, of course, is entitled To the Family Afterwards. And down in my part of the country where I grew up in Al-Anon, we took a paragraph from this chapter and we made of it a preamble that we used to open our meetings. And this is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problems. We feel that each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. My friends, that's heavy stuff. That is heavy stuff. And that's what we've tried to do over the years in the part of the country that I come from. And I was extremely fortunate when I got here because I was exposed to the spiritual giants in this program, the Chuck Chamberlains and the Al Badgers and the Horace Sports and oh so many. And I was scared to death. I was 1,700 miles from my family right in the big middle of Texas. And that's a very exclusive part of the country, I guess you know. You have to be born there to be a Texan. I'm a Texan by marriage. And I was scared out of my ever-loving mind. And I went to these dear people and I said to them, I don't understand, Bill. I just do not understand the man I'm married to. Bill hates a liar, but he can't tell the truth. And he's irresponsible. I don't know if he's coming home or when he's coming home. I just do not understand. And they said to me, read this book, Arbutus. Read this book. It will describe the illness of alcoholism for you. It will teach you the philosophy that you're going to need for your recovery. And I can think of no better reason to read the big book. And I require the people that I sponsor to study the first 164 pages of the big book or get themselves another sponsor. Doesn't matter to me at all. But if you're not willing to find out the nature of the illness that troubles your life and learn the philosophy that you're going to need for your recovery, I quite frankly don't have time for you. I get in a lot of trouble in the Al-Anon family groups because they don't like me to say those things, but I continue to say them because I have been here longer than they have. And there's nobody around that can dispute me. I try to tell you the truth, but I want you to remember that this is my perspective. It may or may not be the truth, but it's all I've got and you'll have to accept it. I attended my first open AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948, and I did not want to go to that meeting. The only reason that I went to that meeting is because I had put myself under obligation to a very beautiful woman who was married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you haven't picked up on the accent yet, I'm a hillbilly. I grew up in the hills of North Carolina, and hillbillies do not like to be obliged. And that's the only reason that I went to that meeting. As I said, it was an open meeting. There was about 150 people there, and you probably noticed this weekend that I drink a lot of coffee. And I'm sure I had been many times to the coffee bar, and after we were seated in the meeting, a beautiful lady leaned across Marguerite and whispered to me. And what she said was, how long has it been since you had a drink, honey? And I wasn't embarrassed by her question, but Marguerite was. She was absolutely embarrassed to death, and she answered the question for me. She said, Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My father was a two-fisted construction man who worked hard, who played hard, and who drank hard. Dad was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to love poetry. He taught me to sing Irish folk songs. He had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, my dad turned into a devil. My father's alcoholism destroyed both my parents. My father's alcoholism changed my beautiful mother into an old, ugly, bitter woman who hated him. She hated him as long as she lived. She hated him long after he was dead and in his grave. In the last 4 years of her life, which she spent in total darkness, she hated anybody that had ever loved John Martin, and that included me. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. I think the most horrible thing that happens to those of us who left alcoholic is the ingrown fear that never leaves us that you will die drunk. And for many, many years after I found the courage in this program to ask the God of my understanding for special favors, I closed every day of my life with one prayer. God, don't let my dad die drunk. I cannot tell you why that is so horrible to us. I can only tell you that it is. God, don't let my dad die drunk. My father died in 1965. He did not die drunk. My father had throat cancer. He couldn't even swallow water. Now, you know very well that I didn't want that filthy stuff to destroy that beautiful baritone voice. You know I didn't. You know I didn't want it to be impossible for my dad to even have a drink of water. You know I didn't. But I prayed, God, don't let my dad die drunk. I do not tell you these things about my dad or about my mother that you may weep for them. My dad's all right. My dad doesn't have to drink anymore. And mother doesn't hate him any longer. I tell you these things that you may know that I have always loved an alcoholic. And because I love alcoholics, I want to restore their families. I'd like you to know that when I married this tall Texan that became the father of my children, I was not concerned with Bill's drinking. Father Martin says the only way you can identify an alcoholic is by the one that you know, and Bill did not drink like Dad. Bill was not a hallucinating drunk who saw creeping, crawling things. Bill was a life of the party type drink. He crashed debutante's parties and taught the sponsors how to put your little foot. And I was not concerned in one little bit. I drank with Bill. We worked for a company that sent us all over the United States, and we got drunk everywhere we went. My Lord of mercy, we've been drunk in Chicago. Whew, Lordy. And that was one of Bill's favorite watering places, Chicago, Illinois. But in 1940, two things happened that should have made Bill and me grow up. We became parents. And the world became involved in a war. And I quit drinking with Bill. Things were too serious. I was watching the casualty list. Both my brothers were in the military, and Bill had family members in service. And I didn't drink with Bill anymore. I was watching the troop movements in Europe and later in the South Pacific, and Bill had lost his drinking partner. We had our second child the next year, and Bill was not there when Nancy was born. She came on Wednesday, and she didn't meet her father till Sunday. And when Bill came to the hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio, he caused a great deal of confusion. He wanted to teach the Catholic nun who was in charge of the maternity ward the Texas Stomp, and the dear sister didn't want to dance. And when they, two big burly orderlies, took Bill out of the hospital, he sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window, forced the motorman to stop so he could tell him about our new baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. And then the next year we had our little boy. Now, don't get too nervous. There's not that many children involved, and the fact of the matter is, my brothers were in the military, my mother and my sisters went into defense plants, and I stayed home and kept up production. But I knew that Bill wanted a little boy, and I couldn't talk about that for a long time because of the guilt feeling I had. I manipulated that pregnancy and gave Bill O'Neill his son. And when Luther was born, he was born with a birth defect, and the doctors told us he would never walk. And then I was absolutely overwhelmed with guilt because I knew that I was responsible. Teresa was born in 1943, bless her heart, and she was one of those beautifully healthy babies that thrived on love and neglect, and that's all she got, because I toured these United States one crippled children's hospital after another to find a doctor that would make my son walk. I didn't pray for Luther to walk because I didn't have anything to pray to, and I had infinite trust and belief in medical doctors, and this is how I spent my time. I sometimes forget to say that Luther did learn to walk. When he weighed into the Navy when he was not quite 18 years old, he weighed in at 189 pounds, and he walked beautifully. I used to watch him run across the parking lot or jump a fence and get a lump in my throat because this was the little boy that wasn't supposed to walk. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And I want you to know that when I came to Texas in 1944, I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. I had never heard the term. But I watched this boy lose everything that he had that he wanted to keep. I watched him lose job after job after job. I saw him lose the respect of the people he worked for. I saw him lose the affection of his own family. And finally, I saw him lose his own self-respect. And I never shall forget the day when Bill was physically and psychologically incapable of getting out of bed to go to work. And he looked up at me and said, "Why don't you take the children and leave, honey? I'm no damn good." As far as I'm concerned, that was the most melancholy day of my life. Bill paid a large price to booze. My Bill lost his left eye in a drunken accident, and he couldn't stop drinking. 6 weeks after we were married, my Bill lost his left arm in a drunken accident, and he could not stop drinking. And I watched this happen. I watched this happen, and I wanted to help Bill. With every fiber of my being, I wanted to help my Bill. And I couldn't help him. And I'm going to say something directly to you alcoholics. I've heard some of you stand at podiums like this and say non-alcoholics don't know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I've held drunken women in my arms when they were in convulsions, walked them up and down, fed them black coffee to get them sober, and gone home to send my own children to school, grateful in the knowledge that, but for the grace of God, that somebody might be walking me up and down and feeding me black coffee. And I've held my Bill in his arms when he was in convulsions. When I didn't know which one of those eyes was the artificial eye, I watched the sanity leave his eyes, scared to death that he wouldn't live till morning, scared to death that if he did live, he wouldn't have any sanity left. I know what I'm talking about. We wanted to help you, but you wouldn't let us. I think the feeling I'm trying to describe to you so poorly is the feeling that those of you who are parents will recognize. It's the feeling you have when you tend a sick baby. The baby cries, it's burning up with fever, and you want to help the baby. But you can't help the baby because the baby can't tell you where it hurts. And the alcoholic couldn't tell us where they hurt, and we couldn't help you. But I want you to remember that we wanted to. We wanted to help you. And I hope you'll remember that the next time you poke fun at an Al-Anon member. I'd like you to remember that. We wanted to help you. And there's a strong possibility in my mind that some of you are here today that wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for somebody like me. And we have a rule in Al-Anon that you may not know about. It's absolutely a no-no to criticize an alcoholic. We don't poke fun at drunks. We don't make fun of sick people in Al-Anon. And maybe you didn't know that. If I should write a very clever article for our newsletter called The Forum and criticize an alcoholic, they would return it, and very likely with a red pencil they write in the margin just what I said. We don't make fun of sick people. When I came to Texas, it was an experience. I went there with expectations, unreal expectations. I thought if Bill got back to his part of the country with the people who loved him, that I'd have a support group. And this didn't happen. They readily understood, his family did, and Bill's one of 11 children. They understood readily why Bill O'Neill drank. It's because he was married to that Yankee from North Carolina, where they make all that bourbon liquor and all those nasty cigarettes that's killing all the youth folks. So they didn't have any problem figuring out why Bill drank. And going back to Mother, she was, Mother was only 12 years older. Well, Mother was only 18 years older than me. And she hated my Bill. She hated him with a purple passion. After he got in AA, she thought she hatched him. Gradually, of course, Bill's family realized that there really was a problem that they needed to recognize. And we kind of maintained an armed truce through the years. And I think they gradually got some respect for me. But it was hard-earned, I'll tell you that for sure. Like I said a while ago, if you're not born in Texas, you're a second-grade citizen as far as they're concerned. And so the best I can do is to tell you that I'm a Texan by marriage. But when we came to Texas, as I said, no one had ever made reference to alcoholism when I talked to clergymen and lawyers and anybody that would talk to me about our problem. No one had ever identified Bill as being an alcoholic. And then when we got to Texas, we met a new group of people. This was a weird group of people who called themselves AA members, and they understood what was the matter with Bill. They also understood what was the matter with me, because then I met another group of people. Now, if I thought the AA people was weird, that was this other group of non-alcoholics, they were doubly weird. These people, though, had found it vitally necessary to use the principles of the AA program to restore their sanity and to preserve their stability. And they didn't know what to do with me. But I had a gray-eyed sponsor, a gray-eyed Texas gal who was my sponsor, and back in the 40s, they were writing lots of articles about alcoholism and in the field of mental health. And so I thought an Al-Anon member, Al-Anon meeting was like a therapy group. And you know, in a way it is. And so I went off to this group meeting expecting to be fixed right away. And those people put my nose down in those 12 steps. And I had the distinct feeling that if I didn't work those steps, they wouldn't let me come up for air. And so I made up my mind that I'd work those blasted steps better than anybody else had ever worked them, and I was going to get an A+ up in the corner of my paper. I'd never seen anything else on my papers. And I was going to slap that paper down in front of that gray-eyed sponsor and say, I took these damn steps and they didn't work. And they did. Now, the primary reason that I wanted to change my life was the very fact that my four children was afraid of me. Now, don't misunderstand me. I am not a child abuser. My children were afraid of my disapproval. If one of my children was in a school play, I had to watch it from the wings, because if I sat out in the audience, they forgot their lines. And I can recall one time when Peggy made a C in an algebra class, and when she got her grade card, she was afraid to bring it home. And the principal called me. And he said, I found Peggy outside my office door, Mrs. O'Neill, and she was crying. And I asked her why she was crying, and she said she was afraid to come home. And I said, in name of conscience, why is she afraid to come home? It's only a half a block. And he said, Mrs. O'Neill, Peggy made C in her algebra class, and she's afraid to bring her grade card home. And I don't want you to say one word to that child. She did the best she could. You may have made an A in algebra, but the best that she could do was a C, and I don't want you to open your mouth. That's a principal of the high school talking to me like that. But I didn't say anything about important failure to make an A in algebra. I put her in summer school so she could bring up her grade before she started away to college, but I didn't scold her for 1 minute because that principal really read me the riot act. And my Bill was ashamed of me. I know that boy was dreaded to come home on the weekends because we lived in a 12-room house and I worked for 52 hours every week, and I maintained a household that would stand a white glove inspection, especially on weekends when Daddy was coming home. I cooked up food and put it in the freezer so I wouldn't have to spend all the time in the kitchen. Everything was alphabetized in my spice cabinet. It was weird. I didn't want my children to be afraid of me, and I didn't want Bill to be ashamed of me, and that's why I came to Al-Anon, because I wanted to change. And that's what the Al-Anon program is all about, how to change your life. Some of these people had terrible, terrible experiences that I had never had, but they seemed to understand me, and I made friends. And that was a new experience. I knew lots of people, but I couldn't name a half a dozen people that I could claim for friends because I wouldn't try to make friends with people. I didn't want them to know what went on within the walls of my home. And when you do that, you don't make very many friends. But I made friends first right in my own little group. And then I was elected delegate for the whole state of Texas. That's a pretty good piece of real estate. One member of my group thought I should not have been delegate because I'm not a Texan, and so the next day we had two groups, and that's what causes new groups, you know, coffee pot and a resentment. By this time Peggy was married, and Nancy and Teresa were still in school, and Luther was in the Navy. And I had an opportunity to fly on my first jet airplane. I wrote to Luther and I told him I had to make a decision. I had to fly from Dallas to New York City on a jet airplane or admit I was a coward. And you know very well I was not going to admit that I was a coward. But I went to the first conference meetings, and there was 11 other people there from different parts of the country. And I realized then that I had friends all over the world if I would identify myself as a member of the Al-Anon family group. And some of you told me that you liked me, and then I could belong to the human race. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And we took the principles of this program and reared those four children. And there was a time that I stood behind microphones like this and said out loud that I would put my four up against any four in the whole United States, and I meant it. When Teresa was graduated magna cum laude from the university, I said, that ain't bad for a drunk kid. When Luther came home from the Navy, he started a little business with his dad's help, and he had 25 men older than he was working for him. And again, I said, that ain't bad for a drunk kid. And time went by, of course, as it always does, and I started getting some very upsetting telephone calls. I got calls from Austin, Texas, and my AA friends would say to me, you can go to sleep now, Arbus. We followed Luther home, and he turned in his own driveway. And then I would get a call from the other side of Texas to tell me that Nancy had fallen in the restroom at the country club and cut her eye on one of the fixtures, but she was going to be all right. They had to take some stitches, but she's going to be all right. Now, of course, you understand the floor was wet. But I'd been in Al-Anon a long time. Nancy was married to a young psychiatrist who referred, law mercy knows how many people, to the program of AA and Al-Anon, but he couldn't live with his wife's sobriety. He didn't seem to be falling down drunk, but when she got in AA, he was very uncomfortable. He went to Al-Anon meetings and describes the effect of alcohol on the human body, and I'm sure the group appreciated it, but he couldn't handle it, and it was a very, very messy divorce. Jack had every intention of institutionalizing our daughter, and there was no way on earth that we could have prevented it because he was, quote, next of kin. So Nancy fled the country. She went to Mexico, and she lived down there for 5 years. And here I am, in Al-Anon, umpteen years. I have two members of my family that need the program, and fortunately, I used a little common sense. I did not try to help them. I did not try to help them. And when Nancy was in Mexico, I'd heard terrible stories about what happens to AA ladies, how they were exploited, and I'd heard horrible stories about the Mexican jails, and I put my own daughter in my imagination. I put her on Skid Row. I couldn't even repeat the Serenity Prayer. I was so distraught over the fact that Nancy couldn't even live in her own country because she had alcoholism. I can report to you today that Nancy celebrated 17 years of sobriety the 4th day of September. And Luther had stacked up 15 years before he died last March. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. I always talk too long and probably don't say anything that's worth remembering, but I always try to close my meeting the same way, and I've been doing this for a large number of years, as some of you know. And I want to remind all of you who are here today that this program of ours carries a message that the whole world needs to know. And you are the only people on earth that are so uniquely qualified to carry this message, because you have lived with the problem. If we fail to carry this message, right here in this premium town of yours and down in Brownwood, Texas, yes, out at Laguna Beach, John, there are drunken men and women who will die never knowing that they're alcoholic, as did Stephen Foster, if you fail to carry this message. And there's kids. The kids are the ones that always get to me. There are kids down in Brownwood, Texas, here in your pretty town, and every town that I can think of. Kids who never heard of the Alateen meetings. Kids who are afraid for their dad to come home tonight. This is Saturday, and Saturday nights were the worst of all. These kids will grow up with deformed personalities if we fail to carry this message. And if we fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on these people. And may God have mercy on us.